Republican leaders from across the state are gathered in Orlando this week for a discussion about strategy in the upcoming election. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It's the 2018 Sunshine Summit. It's where the first Republican debate will take place in the gubernatorial primary. We'll talk with the Florida Republican Party leader about the big issues at this year's summit. Plus, the story of an unarmed black man being shot by police in North Miami made national headlines. Charles Kinsey was the caretaker who was trying to protect an autistic man during a police standoff. But whatever happened to the autistic man, Arnaldo Rios?
In reality, the majority of autistic people don't have access to even the services that are currently available.
We talk with the producer of a new podcast called After Effect. And a conversation with artist Karen Rifas about her first solo art show in more than a decade. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. I do want to remind you that we're still in our summer pledge drive, but for today's show, we're going back to full live and no interruptions. But please make that pledge of support if you can. You can either call or go online. Well, Republican primary candidates Ron DeSantis and Adam Putnam are going to face off in a debate for the first time at the Sunshine Summit, which is taking place today and tomorrow. The two-day event starts tonight. It will take place at the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center in Orlando. The summit brings Republican speakers, donors, activists, and party leaders together to discuss issues and the future of the party. Fox News Channel and the Republican Party of Florida have teamed up for day one of the event to televise a one-hour debate between the two Republican gubernatorial candidates. And on day two, there will be several conversations with conservative leaders in the Republican Party, followed by a panel called Puerto Rico Rising. Florida GOP Chairman Blaise Ingolia launched the first Sunshine Summit in 2015, and he joins us now by phone from the summit. Chairman Ingolia, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure.
All right, so tell us a little bit about this year's summit. What do you see is really going to be the key for the summit this year?
Well, the key for the summit, like the last summit that we started a couple of years ago, is to get all of our grassroots, our donors, our elected officials, our candidates in one place and really tell the message that the Republican Party has the best solutions, the best policy ideas, and it's a rallying cry for the November election.
Now, what do you see as some of the bigger issues that will dominate the conversation for Republicans in this year's summit?
I think you're going to hear a lot about the economy, about the tax cuts. You're going to hear about how Florida has been leading the nation when it comes to job growth, when it comes to stripping back regulations. You know, one of the things that we are very proud here in the state of Florida is that we are the same size as the state of New York, but we have half the budget that New York has. So everyone wants to move here because of the coastline, the sunshine. But a lot of it is because we have no state income tax, and it's a great place to start a business and raise a family.
Well, let's talk about a couple of the other big issues that are going on nationally, and Florida has been at the center of them. One of them, I'd imagine, is going to be immigration. How do you see the story of immigrant children being separated from their parents and being put into camps here in South Florida? How do you think that's going to play out in the next couple of days?
Well, the first thing I would say is that if you remember, Donald Trump, then candidate Donald Trump, ran as a big part of his platform on a zero tolerance in terms of illegal immigration, but also offered solutions for legal immigration. And, you know, he got a mandate from the people and he won the state of Florida running on that platform. So while I think that, yeah, there have been some hiccups, what everyone has to really realize is that it's been 40 years since somebody tried to fix this problem. And President Donald Trump is not afraid to take on the big issues. Now, the thing that we are frustrated with is that there are a lot of very good Republicans who want to solve this problem, but they can't do it without Democrat help. And the issue here, and I totally agree 1,000% with our president, is that Democrats would rather not have it fixed because they want a campaign issue to run on. They would rather campaign on the issue than actually fix the problem. How do we know that? Back in 2009, when then President Barack Obama was president, at one point they had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. They could have gotten anything passed. Then candidate Barack Obama one of his campaign promises is that he was going to fix the illegal immigration issue. They never did, because they would rather campaign on the issue and fix the issue. And I think a lot of people are going to see through that.
You have said in a former interview with Fox that you don't want to see families torn apart. But, and as you said, you believe that the Democrats have no solutions for this. What is one solution? How do you see this ending, and how do you see families brought back together?
So, obviously, it's going to take an act of Congress. It's going to take laws, because you have two laws that are colliding with each other and a court ruling. Now, I am not in I'm in the state legislature. I'm not in Congress. So, I'm not going to offer any solutions myself. But in order to fix this problem, you're going to need everybody at the table. Republicans are willing to be at the table. Unfortunately, right now, the Democrats just aren't.
We've seen some Republicans, including Governor Rick Scott, disalign themselves from Trump on this initial policy of separating the children at the border. To what extent will Florida Republicans at the summit today and tomorrow find a common ground with the president, or do you think that they have to disconnect from his policies?
Well, the first thing is that, remember, this wasn't necessarily his policy, so they're not disconnecting from his policy. And in addition, the president recognized that there was an issue and he fixed it, and they're still attempting to fix it. But having said all that, each individual candidate running for office is going to have her or his own different take on the issue and how to fix the issue. We are not monolithic. You do not have party leaders telling candidates and telling elected officials what to do. The Republican Party is a clash of ideas, and we all sit in a room and we hammer it out, we talk, we have thoughtful debate, and we come up with a solution that everybody can agree on. But we can't get that solution passed unless the Democrats come to the table, and they are not willing to come to the table because they would rather campaign on the issue than fix the problem.
And if they continue to do that, though, are you worried that images of children in these camps could be damaging during this election year?
No, because I think at the end of the day, they're going to realize two things, is that we're trying to fix the problem, which is more than what we can say about the opposition party. And the second thing is that we're not afraid to take on these big challenges, and that the Democrats aren't.
We're talking with Florida GOP Chairman Blaise Ingolia, and we're talking about the Sunshine Summit. It's taking place today and tomorrow. It's at the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center in Orlando. Republican leaders from across the state and the country are there over the next couple of days. There's also going to be a debate, of course, the gubernatorial debate between the two Republican candidates, Ron DeSantis and Adam Putnam. Chairman Ingolia, let's talk about that debate. First of all, what do you expect to see?
What I expect to see is thoughtful debate and two leaders in their own right on the stage offering solution and have a grasp of the issues, which would be in sharp contrast to the Democrats. If anybody got a chance to see the very first Democrat debate, you had four people who were all running on a platform of education reform, but not one of them could tell you how much we spent, what our budget was at the state level in terms of K-12 education. That's a little embarrassing. If you're going to run on that platform, you should clearly know they weren't prepared. Our candidates will be prepared. We'll be prepared to take on the big questions, offer bold solutions, and people, if you have a chance to contrast the two and watch both of them back to back, it's clear who's going to be better for their families.
Is the Florida Republican Party supporting any one candidate, either DeSantis or Putnam?
No, sir. The Republican Party remains neutral. We will remain neutral. Our job is to get the Republican nominee elected. So while we have many people who will volunteer and advocate for Commissioner Putnam, we have another group of people who will volunteer and advocate for Congressman DeSantis. But at the end of the day, after August 28th, we all come together. Our job is to get the Republican elected, and that's what we're going to do.
Recent polls on Fox and NBC show Putnam with a double-digit lead over DeSantis, but DeSantis has been praised by the president on Twitter and received a full endorsement. How do you see the president playing a role in this year's election?
Well, I think the president is already playing a role in the gubernatorial primary here. Obviously, he's endorsed Congressman Ron DeSantis. But the president is also playing kingmaker, if you will, in some of these elections across the United States. So right now it's still early. There's still 2 full months. I know a lot those campaigns are holding back a lot and waiting, and it's going to be a mad dash to the finish. And that's what you can expect between now and August 28th. A lot of grassroots, a lot of knocking on doors, a lot of, having coffee in people's kitchens. And we're just going to take the message to the people.
How do you see the issue of gun control come up in this week's debate, considering the controversy surrounding the issuance of concealed weapons permits under Commissioner Putnam?
I think it may come up, but that is a that is just a speculation that it may come up. I don't have any inside knowledge, but that is something, obviously, if it does come up, if it is asked by the moderators, by Fox News, that's something that they're going to be discussing.
Now, the summit, I wanted to move over to a couple of the other things that you have going on over the next couple of days, but the summit added a panel for Friday on Puerto Rico. It's been 7 months since Hurricane Maria hit the island, and many Puerto Ricans came to Florida to try to rebuild their lives. The panel is called Puerto Rico Rising. Describe to us what this panel is about.
What this panel is, former AG Jose Fuentes, State Representative Bob Cortez, Speaker of the House Johnny Mendez. And what it is we're going to talk about what the island needs, what it should have had before Maria, what it needs to have after Maria, what Florida Republicans are doing to help out the people who have been displaced here. And how we're working hard with the current administration in D.C. and the island to get them back on their feet stronger than ever before.
Now, we've seen different Republicans on this issue of Puerto Rico. Of course, Governor Scott has visited Puerto Rico. We've seen the work he's tried to do to help Puerto Ricans who are citizens. They're not immigrants. But you also had the president who visited Puerto Rico, and he made the comment at one point where he said, you know what, this is hurting my budget. And, of course, there was the image of him throwing paper towels into a crowd. I mean, what's the strategy in reaching this group of voters, people who've lived in Florida for a while, but people who've now come over to Florida, called Florida now their home? What's the strategy in reaching this group of voters? How do you prove to them the Republican Party is going to be the best choice for them?
Well, the first thing I would say on that is that we, unlike the Democrats, we do not put people into boxes. Our message remains the same, whether we are talking to the farmer in northeast Florida, whether we're talking to the second or third generation Cuban American in South Florida, whether it's somebody who is displaced from the island, or whether it's a businessman in Jacksonville. And that is this, is that we are the party that is going to bring economic prosperity. We are already bringing economic prosperity. We have a great story in the state of Florida, low unemployment rate. We are putting people back to work. People are creating jobs. Entrepreneurs are investing in our state now. And while there are other issues out there, the economy always surfaces as the number one issue. So if you're looking for prosperity, this is the place you want to be, and Republicans should be running the state.
There's obviously a lot of talk about a blue wave this year, but regardless of that, we tend to see voters move Congress in the opposite direction halfway through a president's first term. We saw it with Obama, saw it with Bush, too. We saw it with Clinton. What's the strategy to keep control of the House and Senate, but also to keep control of Tallahassee?
The strategy is take our message door to door, and that's what we have been doing. You know, that little blue wave is going to hit a big red wall come November. If you remember last election cycle, everyone was predicting a Hillary Clinton landslide. Everyone was predicting that Republicans were going to just get swept out of their seats. And what happened? We now have President Donald Trump, and Republicans were swept into the seats. What we have to do and what we are going to do is get out and tell our story, our message about the things that we've been doing here in the state of Florida. And when you contrast that to what the Democrats, Democrat candidates who are running for the Democrat nomination, it becomes a no-brainer. So at the end of the day, you're going to have, and the polling says this, 85% of Republicans are going to vote Republican, 85% of Democrats are going to vote Democrat. It's those NPAs. It is those independent voters, and those people vote with their pocketbook.
Now, you've talked about some of the bigger issues. You say that it always comes back to the economy. It may not, or it may come up in tonight's debate, but if not, it will come up in the general election. The Democrats are going to push on the issue of minimum wage, and many of them are pushing for up to $15 an hour. What is the Republican position right now when it comes to the issue of minimum wage and a working wage in the state of Florida?
We are not for the for government mandating and setting a minimum wage. Even though we have one, we would not. I don't think the party would advocate for $12 or $15 an hour, because you know what? That's inflationary. It will absolutely hurt the people that the Democrats are actually pretending that they care about. And I say pretending, and here's why. So if you have, so let's think about this. Let's walk through this. If you're going to a large burger chain, a fast food burger chain, and all of a sudden everybody now is mandated at a minimum of $15 an hour, and you have the dishwasher getting paid $15 an hour, and now you have the fry cook says, hey, the dishwasher's getting paid $15 an hour, I want $17 an hour. The burger guy says, fry guy is getting 17, I want 20. The manager now said, all of these people are making more than what I used to make, I want $35 an hour. And after all of that, do you really think there's still going to be a dollar menu? Of course not. That's why minimum wage, setting a minimum wage at $15 an hour, it does not work. The market should set it. We should be stripping back some of those regulations. These companies are offering more money now than they have without the government intervening.
Let me finish with this. Every president, Democrat or Republican, is going to push the party, their party, one way or the other. And so I'm wondering, you know, what do you see as the future for the Republican Party going forward? Do you see, you know, is there a question about traditional conservative views, or has Trump moved the party one way or the other? How do you view the future of the party?
I think the future of the Republican Party lies within a conservative ideology, if you will, but with a libertarian bent, because there are a lot of Republicans now in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. They just want government off their back. So while I think they would be reserved with being a conservative and living their lives conservative, they would think that, hey, they don't want to intrude on somebody else and what they want to do, get government off their back, have more actual freedom. I think that's where we're looking at for the Republican Party.
Blazing Goalie again is the Florida GOP chairman, and he is running the Sunshine Summit. It's taking place today and tomorrow. It's at the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center in Orlando. And also part of that summit is the fact that we're going to see the first gubernatorial debate for the Republicans between the two candidates, Ron DeSantis and Adam Putnam. Chairman and Goalie, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
All right, still to come on Sundial, we're going to talk with the folks from WNYC about a new podcast that focuses on a story that shook this community just a couple of years ago. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, next month is going to mark 2 years since the infamous shooting of an unarmed black man in North Miami by police officers caught on cell phone camera. Charles Kinsey was a caretaker for a young autistic man, Arnaldo Rios. The shooting became a national story. It was the same summer the shooting death of Philando Castile was streaming on Facebook Live in St. Anthony, Minnesota, and Alton Sterling was shot and killed in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. They raised important questions about police use of force and relations with communities of color. But one character in this story, back to Miami, received much less media attention, Arnaldo Rios, the young autistic man. What happened to him during and after the incident? Well, that question is at the foundation of a new podcast out of WNYC titled After Effect. The first three episodes are out now, and joining us from the studios of WNYC is the host and reporter, Audrey Quinn. Audrey, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah. Hi, Lewis.
A fascinating podcast, and it brings us back. A lot of us here in South Florida, we remember this story. This was a national story. It rocked the community because, again, it was caught on camera. Miami police responded to a call about two men in the middle of the road. One of them was believed to be holding a gun. There was Arnaldo Rios, the autistic patient, and his caretaker, Charles Kinsey. And, of course, the visual of Kinsey on the road with his hands up and still getting shot was one of those moments that charged up the community. But also there was the fact that police would even consider shooting an autistic person. When you first saw this story, what went through your mind?
Yeah, I was struck by, I think, a lot of the same things that other folks were struck by, of just, why did this happen? Why was Charles the one shot? Why was Arnaldo's behavior something that elicited a police response?
When did you decide that this was something that could be at the center of a podcast, that this was a story in of itself? And again, your focus is not the shooting. It's about this autistic gentleman.
Yeah, this was actually back last summer. Our vice president of news asked me to do some reporting on autistic adults and services for autistic adults. And I ended up kind of going on this deep dive where I was just talking to dozens of autistic adults themselves, asking, what are issues in your community that need to be addressed? What are we missing when it comes to autism and adults? What should people be talking more about? A lot of issues kept coming up, issues around access to services, issues around negative encounters with law enforcement, the additional barriers against autistic people of color, abusive so-called treatments. And also what kept coming up in these conversations is what happened to Arnaldo Rios Soto. I found that Arnaldo's story is really at the nexus of all these issues. And that made me interested to explore further what really did go on there and what happened to Arnaldo next.
So let's take a look at first the relationship between Arnaldo and his caretaker, Charles Kinsey. Let's take a listen to the first episode of the podcast. This is about Charles's early impressions of Arnaldo.
I really liked Arnaldo. He started calling me, Charles. I'm like, what's up, Arnaldo? But he did have his outbursts.
Like physical stuff?
Yeah, and when he done got aggressive. And I had to let him know, Arnaldo, come on, we're not having that here. We're not doing that here, you know. Then he'll calm down. He went, okay, that's him. Okay. I like, all right, let's go back in the room. And you really had to know what he liked. And once you found out what he liked, Arnaldo was fine.
So, Audrey, what did we learn about Arnaldo's history of violent incidents?
We learned Arnaldo's really, really been through a lot, from even in elementary school being abused by teachers to instances of being in group homes when he was a young adult where he was chemically restrained, physically restrained. He's really somebody who has been through some worst case scenarios in terms of the services he was given. And he also is somebody who has acted out aggressively. Arnaldo is what people often refer to as non-speaking. He doesn't primarily use language to express himself. And oftentimes, or sometimes, that results in him using aggression to express himself, acting out physically.
What sort of training and also compensation do caretakers like Charles Kinsey get in the state of Florida for overseeing people with severe disabilities?
The training is pretty minimal. The pay is usually anywhere from, I've been quoted, $8 to $12 an hour. Fairly low wages, often a lot of overtime. And these from what I have seen, these are some of the most difficult jobs you can have.
Now, much of the podcast, as we mentioned, is focused on the people in Arnaldo's life that are needed to tell his story. So let's go to his mother and sister. And I wanted to get your initial reactions, with them in this story.
Yeah. So Arnaldo's mom, Gladys, and his older sister, Miriam, I was just immediately charmed by these two women. They are just such strong advocates for Arnaldo. They really see this as an issue of justice. They believe that Arnaldo has been deprived of the respect and dignity that every human being deserves, and will stop at nothing to make sure he gets that.
And they came from the United States, they came to the mainland United States from Puerto Rico. Yep. What were some of the unique challenges that they were finding when it comes to getting the right services to help Arnaldo?
Yeah, I mean, to begin with, they were folks who were new to this country. English was not their primary language. So there were those barriers. And then there was just figuring out how to get into the system. In the state of Florida, there's a 20,000 person wait list to get Medicaid, home and community based services. Arnaldo did finally get on that wait list, or get to the top of that wait list, when he was a kid. But once he got those services, figuring out which services were actually helpful, which services were safe, was a real challenge. Arnaldo's mom, Gladys, kind of gets caught in the middle, where she's had a lot of times where she's been concerned about the services he's receiving, but she's also been wary of speaking up or speaking out against service providers, because Arnaldo's fate is in their hands.
There's an exchange that you had with Arnaldo's mother and sister that resonates with their struggle to be proper advocates for him. This is from the second episode of the podcast.
What do you think Arnaldo wants?
He wants respect, because always in my house he receives respect. When he said, "Mother, please, I want to be alone."
He doesn't say it exactly like that, but she gets the idea.
And I say, "Okay, papi, 5 minutes. It's okay, 5 minutes?" And I say, "Okay, mother, 5 minutes.
Throughout his life, Arnaldo has gone through so many different type of situations where his rights as a human being have been violated.
Audrey, do you see a level of guilt from family members of those with developmental disabilities?
Guilt in which way?
Well, and I have to say, because, for me, I have a family member who mm-hmm. is very much like Arnaldo and really can't speak. But I always think about how the family reacts to his condition and his situation. And I just wonder, from your experience talking with his family, do they feel any guilt about his condition? Do they put it on themselves in any way?
I mean, I don't think they feel any guilt that Arnaldo is the way he is. They don't see there being anything wrong with Arnaldo being autistic. They do feel guilt that they sleep in their own beds every night, sleep in comfortable rooms, and know that Arnaldo doesn't get to do that. His mom, Gladys, has a lot of trouble sleeping, a lot of nights that she lies awake thinking, here I am in this big comfortable bed, my son doesn't get that.
Do they feel any guilt about the treatment he's getting and trying to find him the right treatment, the best treatment?
Yeah. Gladys, his mom, shared with me some of her calendars she's kept through the years, kind of keeping track of what's going on with Arnaldo. And in the margins of the calendars, she writes how badly she feels that she feels like she hasn't been a strong enough advocate, that she's been a coward. This is someone who has been quite vocal and really has spoken up, but it still hasn't felt like it's been enough.
We're talking with Audrey Quinn, the host and reporter of a new podcast from WNYC titled After Effect. And it looks at the story of this autistic person, Arnaldo Rios. Now, you know him because you remember the story of the shooting of Charles Kinsey. Charles Kinsey was the caretaker of Arnaldo Rios. And this is the story we remember here in South Florida, when Kinsey was shot, even though he was on the ground with his hands up. The first three episodes are out now. Audrey, is it possible that Arnaldo suffered post-traumatic stress disorder from the shooting, that may have exacerbated the outburst that he's having?
Yeah, speaking with Arnaldo's lawyer, who made sure to connect Arnaldo with therapists after the shooting, it sounds like definitely Arnaldo experienced post-traumatic stress. And when you're somebody who is non-speaking, the way that stress can manifest itself can be really difficult, because Arnaldo can't say, like you or I would, "Hey, I'm having a tough time. Hey, I'm stressed out." So sometimes the way that he expresses that trauma can be perceived as simply an act of aggression.
Now, you cover health issues, in your day job. But I'm wondering, what did you know about people with developmental disabilities like Arnaldo? And what have you learned since working on this podcast?
Yeah, I had not had a lot of interaction with folks on the spectrum prior to doing this. I'd known people here and there. But what I learned in doing this reporting, especially getting to know someone who is also intellectually disabled, is just what an alternative universe people like Arnaldo and their families live in that the limitations that are put on Arnaldo's life, not by his disabilities, but by the way he's been treated, really kind of put him in another world than the one the rest of us get to live in.
And it seemed, too, the other thing that popped out for me was that, you know, it's this common problem that reporters have covering mental health stories and again, folks with these disabilities, which is the issue of consent. You have this very interesting exchange with Lydia Brown. She's a law student, disability justice advocate, and autistic herself. And it's talking about Arnaldo's violent outburst. Let's take a listen.
I think it's inappropriate to be talking about Arnaldo specifically at his worst moments in such a public forum, because I wouldn't want someone doing that to me.
Don't be a predatory reporter.
It matters to me so much to do this as well as I can. But I also feel like as journalists, we try to tell the fullest picture of the story as we can. And I'm not going to not share that there are parts of Arnaldo's life that are not beautiful. To me, that feels like I need to go there, because that is...
Is that something that Arnaldo has given you permission to talk about publicly? Because that's the really important question.
Audrey, how do you navigate telling this very sensitive side of your main character's story with questions remaining about consent?
Yeah, this was huge. And I should clarify, I didn't get into this in the podcast. Lydia's pronouns are they, them. And when they said this to me, I was struck, because I'll be honest, I had gone through this reporting thinking, I know what some of the pitfalls are that other journalists fall into, being non-disabled people, reporting on disabled people, and all the ways people can be insincere and all the tropes that come up. And I thought I was avoiding those. And Lydia called out, you don't have Arnaldo's permission here. And that was something that I'll continue to bring up and struggle with through the podcast, of figuring out, is there a way that I can feel like I have Arnaldo's permission? Is how do I do this story and do right by Arnaldo, or at least give him the same amount of agency that I would give someone else I was reporting on?
As I mentioned, the first three episodes are out. There are five more to come. What are some of the keys to the next chapters in After Effect that we can expect?
Yeah. So this next episode that'll be out tomorrow looks a little more deeply at how police and hospitals have really become kind of de facto service providers, because the services that are supposed to be there, that are supposed to primarily treat disabled people, just aren't there. And from there, we actually take a turn looking more deeply into the facility that Arnaldo ended up at, Carlton Palms, and looking at history, looking at what's been going on, looking at what happens next. And ultimately, we follow Arnaldo as he leaves that facility.
Yeah, you know, talking about police, something interesting too is, you know, diving into this issue, when it comes to the police, what do we know about the training that they're given to identify and work with these individuals?
Yeah, it really varies department to department. Actually, the manager of Arnaldo's group home program had tried to get the North Miami police to even just let him come and do trainings on autism, helping police to better identify and respond to autistic people. From what I understand, some of the North Miami police had already had some level of crisis training prior to the shooting with Charles and Arnaldo, but not all of them. Since then, the North Miami police has assured me that they have done an increased amount of autism and developmental disability training. The thing that kind of has stood out to me, though, after all of this is police training is great. Police should be able to recognize developmental disabilities, but it's kind of just a Band-Aid when the developmental disability services system just doesn't have the services to respond to folks in a way that would be helpful. So police end up doing a job that really they shouldn't be doing in the first place.
You know, you've kind of touched on it, but I just wanted to get a sense from you how the reporting you've done on this for this podcast, how it's opened your perspective to the challenges facing the developmentally disabled adult population in this country.
Yeah, it's really, as I said before, it's not a world that I had been used to, and it's something I think twice now when I think about just general issues of accessibility, of even how I respond when I notice somebody acting unusually on the street, and thinking about how my being okay or not okay with someone acting out in public could impact their lives. It could impact their ability to be part of the community.
We've been talking with Audrey Quinn, the host and reporter of a new podcast from WNYC titled After Effect. It's, you remember the story of the shooting of Charles Kinsey. He was the caretaker of the autistic person, Arnaldo Rios. Kinsey, if you remember from the video, he was the man who was lying on the ground with his hands up and police still shot him. But this podcast looks at life, the perspective from the autistic person, from Arnaldo Rios' story. Again, the first three episodes are already out, five more to come. Audrey Quinn, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And again, Audrey was joining us from the studios of WNYC. Well, still to come on Sundial, we're going to meet a well-known Miami artist who has put together her first solo exhibition in over 10 years. That's next on the program. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami-based artist Karen Reifus questions our relationship with space through her minimalist art. Her colorful, shape-focused pieces can be seen in art galleries across the city and at her new exhibition at the Bass Art Museum, Deceptive Constructions. This is her first solo exhibition in 10 years. It explores how we see art from different perspectives, how the viewer can activate the space, and how, as she'll tell you, it's all about where you stand. Reifus joined us in studio. I started off by asking her about her early career in art and the materials that she uses.
I started using oak leaves because they were on my deck and I had to do something with them, like sweep them up. So they were swept up in piles, and I used them to place them around sculpture bases and then use them as actual installations where I piled the leaves around, let's say, the Cox Science Building at University of Miami. So I decided to use them. And then at one point I decided that I would take these leaves and stitch them and send them for installations in Mexico and other places.
So because the fact that you had to clean up leaves, all of a sudden they become part of your art. I mean, what moment did you decide, wait a second, instead? Because look, a lot of people find those things very annoying to have to sweep them up, but
right.
You looked at it differently.
That's true.
I'm
a very economical person.
When did you decide, wait a minute, this is art?
It just worked. It just, you use what's at hand. I mean, you either go to the thrift store and find junk and make it into something, or you you find what's at hand, such as leaves, and use them to accomplish what you want. And each leaf is different. It's a really special, one of a kind, something that I'd want to share with people. And so you can stitch them on a Singer sewing machine on a thread, and it becomes rhythm and repetition. And so it just became a natural thing for me to use.
How would you describe your style? As an artist, how do you describe yourself?
I would say that I'm a site-specific installation artist, which means the site where I'm working with the cord or the leaves or whatever determines how I place objects in space.
Because it's not for you, it's not just about creating artwork, it's about the experience that the viewer is going to have with your artwork.
That's true. And in sculpture, it's three-dimensional, so where you stand is what you'll see. So if you step left, you'll see one formation. If you step right, you'll see another. If you walk behind something or walk around it, leaves or lines will cross in space, and you'll get different views. That's my fun.
With this new exhibit, you are challenging people to move around in this space to really experience your work. It's not static like in some museums and galleries. This is part of your style. So when you're putting this one together, what were you trying to get at? What did you want? What do you want us to experience when we come into this room?
Into this room, I want the viewer to see the expanse of the space. Some people are very visual, and other people just are looking at paintings and never look up. So I want people to see and feel everything in this space.
And you talk about that column. Is that the one people can sit on?
Yes.
And okay, so there's in the back corner of the room, there's a column, and then it looks like it's missing a big chunk of it. But people
Correct.
Can sit on it and then look up and...
And feel uncomfortable or threatened.
Also, the fact that if you, like a lot of your work, if you stand in different positions, you see something different with that same piece, right?
Correct.
There's also, my producer's got this really lovely image. It's actually, before you even go into this room, you see from a distance through the door a couple of the pieces, and you have it set up in such a way that it creates this visual illusion that it's one piece. Then you walk into the room and realize it's not. It's different pieces. But describe that one real quickly for us.
Well, if you stand two houses away and you stand there and line up the bench and this L-shaped column, they'll look like they're joined, that they're one. And they're different colors. There's on the columns and benches are pink and orange and magenta and turquoise. So they react, so you think they're one, but then you realize there's different colors, and then you walk closer and closer, and you realize there's a space between this kind of playpen arrangement of two benches and a almost looks like a painted floor pattern. And then as you change from left to right as you walk through the door, you start to see the rest of the room, and you start to see things that move and don't line up, and it's fun.
I'm talking with Miami-based artist Karen Reifus about her new exhibition at the Bass Art Museum, Deceptive Constructions, her first solo exhibition in 10 years. We have some of the artwork, by the way, on our website, WLRN.org. Some of your pieces are meant to be sat on.
Moved,
shifted around.
And sometimes we have dancers that activate it and actually move it.
So, yeah, well, let me ask you about that, the part where, you know, I can walk in and I can manipulate this the way I want to. Maybe I can move something around. But why did you want to do that? And what's the experience that I get from it?
Well, I want the viewer to be a part of the art. And that means actively engaging with it. So if you're actually walking around something or moving it, it's kind of like a teaching lesson. It's do it and and feel a part of it.
You've worked with a lot of students. You've been teaching art.
Right.
What do you try to instill in the students? What do you want to teach them about, you know, their craft?
I don't really want to teach them about their craft. I want to teach them to be free to investigate and explore and take chances.
I wonder, too, because, you know, I think back to art classes I took in college and the different types of professors that I had. I guess it depends on the type of art that you were doing, but, you know, is it a matter of, you know, helping the student find that something within them, you know, their way of expressing themselves, or, you know, is it just let's teach them the basics, they'll figure it out on their own at some point?
Well, there's two schools and both of them are right. But my feeling is that being free to find your way is more creative than you need craft. I mean, or you develop craft, the craft you need to do the job. But the main thing is the idea. Skill is nice. I'm learning I need more skill.
Looking at Miami, South Florida, the bigger picture, when you talk about art here, and I just wanted to get your take on, are we doing enough to retain artists, to attract artists, to keep this a vibrant cultural center for art?
We're doing better, but we're not doing enough because I still see artists having to go to New York, go to L.A. The reason I taught, and artists and gallerists like Fred Snitzer taught, is that we wanted to try to develop a community of artists that would maybe go off, but come back and then teach and then create a bigger community of artists. It's really important to a mature city.
Even possibly find a way to get artists, even if they do leave, to find a way back. Bring that back with
and
them.
And that means jobs, and that means people that will invest in their art and believe in them.
That was Karen Reifus, artist based here in Miami. Her new exhibition at the Bass Art Museum is called Deceptive Constructions. It's up through October. This is her first solo exhibition in 10 years, and it explores how we see art from many different perspectives. And as she told us, art that you get to activate, you get to experience, you actually get to move stuff around. That's kind of cool when you can touch the art. Usually you can't do that. And you can, of course, see photos on our website and our social media. Just look up WLRN Sundial. Well, that's the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Take care. We'll talk to you later.